Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the new Pope, who is both a doctrinal conservative and a humble man who rides the bus and cooks for himself. Matthew Fox, the author of The Pope's War, Why Ratzinger's Secret Crusade Has Imperiled the Church and How It Can Be Saved, joins us. An internationally acclaimed theologian, Fox was hounded out of the Catholic Church by Cardinal Ratzinger, who later became Pope Benedict. We will discuss the unknown chapters in the background of Cardinal Jorge Mario Bergoglio, in particular why he and the church hierarchy were silent when Argentina's military death squads were torturing and killing fellow priests and bishops who practiced liberation theology. Then we will speak with Kirby Dick, the award-winning filmmaker whose latest documentary, The Invisible War, was nominated in this year's Academy Awards. He attended Wednesday's hearings in the United States Senate on the epidemic of rape in the military, where one in three military women are victims, with 19,000 service members sexually assaulted every year. We will discuss the powerful testimony by women who have been victimized by assaults that are routinely covered up, and questions about the Uniform Code of Military Justice that allows senior officers friendly to the assailants to overturn jury verdicts. Then finally, we'll get an update from CPAC, where conservative activists are gathering to hear from Rand Paul, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, and other Republican rising stars. Adele Stan, Alternet's Washington bureau chief, joins us to report on a gathering dominated by what John McCain calls Republican wacko birds, where moderates like Governor Christie are not invited, but birthers like Donald Trump are welcome. Adele Stan has an article at alternet.com, Rand Paul's No Progressive Hero Despite Anti-Drone Filibuster. Joining us now is Matthew Fox, who's an internationally acclaimed theologian who was a member of the Dominican Order for 34 years. Fox founded the Institute in Culture and Creation Spirituality, which operated for 7 years, but then became a prime target of Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, Pope John Paul II's chief inquisitor and head of the Congregation of Doctrine and Faith. Ratzinger, who later became Pope Benedict, silenced Fox for 1 year in 1988 and ultimately forced him to step down as director of the ICCS. 3 years later, he expelled Fox from the order. Fox has taught at Stanford University, Vancouver School of Theology, the Association for Transpersonal Psychology, and California Institute for Integral Studies. He is currently visiting scholar with the Academy for the Love of Learning, headquartered in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and is the author of 28 books, which have sold more than 1.5 million copies. His bestsellers include Original Blessing, A Spirituality Named Compassion, The Coming of the Cosmic Christ, and Prayer, A Radical Response to Life. His latest book is The Pope's War, Why Ratzinger's Secret Crusade Has Imperiled the Church and How It Can Be Saved. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Fox.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And I just wanted to get something clarified about what the new Pope said today, Pope Francis I. He warned that the Catholic Church would become a compassionate NGO without spiritual renewal, saying that what would happen would be like when children make sandcastles and then it all falls down. Can you translate that to a layperson?
Pardon me for laughing. That your question was funny, translating it for a layperson. Well, I'm certainly on board with spiritual renewal, and I'm on board with the idea that the whole thing is collapsing. It can all fall down like a sandcastle. I begin my book on the Pope's War with a beautiful story, really, from Bede Griffiths, who is a wonderful monk, an authentic, very holy man. He's deceased now, but he lived in India for 50 years. He's from Britain, Benedictine monk. And he told me last time I saw him before he died, he said, you know, don't worry about the Vatican. Don't even look over your shoulder. Keep doing what you're doing, planting the new shoots, because one day it's all going to come tumbling down, just like the Berlin Wall. And I thought that was a very interesting observation, because I think we're living at such a time. I think that this pedophile crisis and its cover-up and the financial shenanigans that have been going on for so long, so much of it has is proof that the thing is tumbling down. The Inquisition has returned under the last two popes, and so thinking has stopped. It's like General Motors firing all their engineers. They fired all their theologians, essentially. I have a list of 105 in the back of my book. I'm just one of them, but we've been hounded, harassed, expelled. Some have died of heart attacks and had nervous breakdowns. because the ideology running things is that only the Pope is the teacher. So, you know, it is tumbling down. I'm glad he has that much of awareness. I'm not sure that I hope and I pray that he can rehabilitate things, but I'm concerned because his spirituality comes from what I can understand about his story, from Communion and Liberation, which is a neo-fascist movement out of Italy, very parallel to Opus Dei, which was out of Spain. He's very committed to that movement, as is Cardinal Ratzinger, as is Cardinal Law, who is the notorious ex-Archbishop of Boston, who passed pedophile priests from parish to parish. And Communion Liberation, and I have a section on them, half a chapter in my Pope book, is all about hierarchy. It's all about obeying. And it's preoccupied with sexual morality, birth control, condoms, no condoms, abortion, and so forth. It has nothing to say really to the world that is inspiring or liberating or justice oriented, really. So it's a concern to me that this man, whether he has the stuff to break out of that box of Communion Liberation, which really voted him in, because it is the especially the German wing of the church that has been promoting that. And many bishops around the world, in South America as well as in Italy, have fought it tooth and nail because they realize it's a sect. It's as is Opus Dei, and yet these are the organizations that the last two papacies have put all the wind in the sails of these organizations. So this is part of what this Pope has to confront. Whether he's capable, I do not know. I send my prayers and I hope, but I don't think we should be looking to popes these days. I think we have to push the restart button on Christianity at the grassroots, and I think the papacy as we know it is finished. It's become theater. It's a museum, and we have to start the church over, and the church is the people. That's what Vatican II said, it's the people, not the hierarchy.
So if the church is the theater, is this new pope then a kind face on a cruel theology?
I think you put it very, very well. And I would just, as I say, hope and pray that maybe his theology could be pierced, could be reinvented, that the Holy Spirit might really zap him. Miracles do happen. But yes, I think he's a kind face. He has a kind story, the story of taking buses to work and cooking his own meals and all that's very nice. But his record, for example, on standing up to the military junta and the terrible destruction they did, including murdering fellow bishops and fellow Jesuit priests and torturing them, he was not heard around that when he was in his 50s. So that's not a good sign. His attacks on liberation theology and base communities all over Latin America, that's a very bad sign. You see, Communion Liberation is very anti-liberation theology. A very interesting thing has come out in the last 24 hours. A fellow from Argentina who did interviews with him, sort of an autobiographical writer, he said, "This man is not a third world person." Now, that's an amazing sentence since he was born in Argentina and has lived there his whole life, except when he went away to study in Germany about 8 years ago, and it's odd to get a doctorate in your late 60s when you're already a cardinal. But he did that. He went to Germany. I think in Germany he hung out with Ratzinger's kind of people, and he just got more cemented into the Communion Liberation ideology, and they kind of prepared him for this job to follow Ratzinger, because the German bishops are the most influential in the world because they bring more money to the Vatican than anyone else. Because they tax in Germany, you know, they tax Catholics. Whether you come to church or not, the tax money keeps flowing, and then it flows from Germany into Rome. So I think that's very significant that that his biographer says he's not a third world person. So the front is that he's a third world person. He looks like a third world person. He's lived as a third world person. But his consciousness, is nowhere near. I mean, you can talk to people of Argentina or read what they're blogging about, and it's rare to find anyone who thinks highly of him, frankly. They call him an arch-conservative. He blasted gays and the idea of gay marriage as a work of the devil, the father of lies, he says, has birthed this. The president of Argentina said that he was sounding like an Inquisition, like the Middle Ages. And so, you know, you hope and you pray that he'll be better than it looks like. He does have a disposition that seems tender and genuine. I liked how before he gave a blessing, he asked for one. I thought that was a big improvement. But you know, you got to go deeper than that. Can this guy really clean up the mess in the Curia? I think, practically speaking, if I were a journalist, I would watch for his appointment as Secretary of State. The Secretary of State in the Vatican runs things. And will he really appoint someone who's tough, who knows how to change things inside, and who really wants reform inside that rat's nest? Or will he just appoint someone who will allow things to continue as they are? And because the corruption there is the greatest corruption since the Borgias. This is not an exaggeration. It's the greatest corruption since the Borgias.
Again, I'm speaking with Matthew Fox, who's an internationally acclaimed theologian who was a member of the Dominican Order for 34 years. Fox founded the Institute for Culture and Creation Spirituality, which operated for 7 years, but then became a prime target of Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, Pope John Paul II's chief inquisitor and head of the Congregation of Doctrine and Faith. Ratzinger, who later became Pope Benedict, silenced Fox for 1 year in 1988 and ultimately forced him to step down as director of ICCS. 3 years later, he expelled Fox from the order. Matthew Fox is the author of 28 books, which have sold more than 1.5 million copies, and his bestsellers include Original Blessings, A Spirituality Named Compassion, The Coming of the Cosmic Christ, and Prayer, A Radical Response to Life. His latest book is The Pope's War, Why Ratzinger's Secret Crusade Has Imperiled the Church and How It Can Be Saved. So Matthew Fox, the fact that Pope Francis I is a Jesuit, and the fact that the first thing he did, apparently, was summon a meeting with Father Federico Lombardi, the head of the Vatican Radio and the Vatican's press office, which has been run by the Jesuits, but they've been basically kept out of the loop, particularly by this retiring or Pope Emeritus Benedict Ratzinger, who just sort of basically phoned, they just received orders from the Vatican Secretary of State. But apparently that's changed. So does that give you any, is there anything significance to that?
Are you sure is Father Lombardi the press secretary for the Pope? That name?
Federico Lombardi, head of the Vatican Radio and the Vatican Radio. Press Office, yeah.
I see, okay. Somehow I thought that the head of the press office was Opus Dei, not a Jesuit. But I do know that the Jesuits used to run the radio, but I think they were trying to... Opus Dei was trying to take it over from the Jesuits. So that's kind of interesting that he's...
Yeah, well, that's true. The Vatican Radio has been run by the Jesuits, not the Vatican Press Office.
Ah, okay.
But the fact that...
A big distinction.
Yeah.
Because the press office is run by Opus Dei and has been since John Paul II. And I tell you, I was always amazed that the press and the media never thought that was odd and never asked them about Opus Dei and why Opus Dei is representing the Pope so thoroughly. But, yeah, there's a battle within the Jesuit order, of course. Remember that four Jesuits were martyred in El Salvador, and just like, of course, Oscar Romero, the bishop, was. But you see, the struggle for liberation theology in Latin America has been a struggle of life and death, and that's why to see this man who did not take the side of the martyrs but linked up with communal liberation instead is disconcerting. Maybe he's, you know, maybe now that he's in a position where he can do what he really wants to do, maybe he will make some significant moves. I hope that's the case.
Well, Matthew Fox, Pope Pius XII, of course, was continually criticized, both when he was alive and since, about his apparent indifference to the Holocaust and the extent to which he sort of played footsie with the Third Reich. Mm-hmm. And subsequently, apologists for Pope Pius have always said that he really did some courageous things behind the scenes, but they never said what they were. And I think it's extremely important that for this new pope to reveal what was going on with him during Argentina's dirty war, as you mentioned, when his fellow priests and bishops were being murdered by the military junta and tortured and disappeared. Nothing is more profound in terms of my curiosity. So are we going to get some clarity on that?
Well, again, I think you're asking a very good question, but you're asking it the wrong person in this case. I think you're right to put that question to him and to his handlers, if you will. What really, where was he? You know, where was he? I understand that very soon, one of the generals who was responsible for that, for the murder of the bishop, because they did murder a liberation theologian bishop, that he is up for trial very soon, and that could shed tremendous light on this whole thing, exactly how it went off and who responded and who didn't. I have been told that Argentinians don't like to call it the dirty war. They just want to call it a dictatorship. It was a war of the dictators. And many people did stand up. Many priests stood up and sisters and lay leaders, and they were tortured and killed, just like in Chile, many stood up to Pinochet, and he tortured and murdered many priests and nuns and lay people. But Pope John Paul II picked for his Secretary of State Sodano, who was the ambassador, papal ambassador to Chile, and was very close to Pinochet. Pinochet gave him a special award. And this guy, Sodano, then ran the church. He was Secretary of State for, 26 years that John Paul II was Pope. I mean, that alone is a scandal of scandals. Then Bertone, who was Cardinal Ratzinger's hand-picked Secretary of State, he was very close to this Father Maciel, this horrible priest who abused over 20 seminarians in his seminary and was married on the side to two women, had four children, all of whom he sexually abused. And he was so close to John Paul II that he would take him on plane rides with him when he would go to different countries. And yet this Bertone, who's Secretary of State, wrote a preface to Maciel's book saying, oh, this is the work of such a holy, holy, holy man. Actually, it's been proven that the very book by Maciel was a plagiarism. It plagiarized. 80% of it was taken from a priest who died in 1943. And then Bertone was praising Maciel and his silly book. So, you know, there have been such goings on for 42 years that it makes you almost numb to think about it. And the press has given John Paul II a complete carte blanche, a Teflon papacy, and all of this pedophile stuff exploded under John Paul II, and he did nothing. I like to compare it to the Penn State pedophile crisis. You know, once they got through their denial and realized this is happening and happened, they fired everybody in sight. They put people in jail. They even tore down the statue of the football coach, who was such an icon. In the Vatican, they're not tearing down John Paul II's statue. They're trying to canonize him a saint. So, you know, this is, as I say, this is corruption quadrupled.
So on Saturday, when the new Pope Francis meets the world's media at a special papal audience, you mentioned my question was directed to the wrong person, which is what were you doing during the dirty war, Pope Francis? So do you think anybody's likely to ask that question? Is there any...
Why don't you go?
Well, you can ask my employees to give me a plane ticket. This is impoverished public radio. They'll, you know... they don't give me the means to even make a daily radio program, so I don't see them flying me to Rome.
Well, you must know your journalist brothers and sisters better than I do.
I just wonder whether it's going to be a real press conference or right. One of those ones where somebody picks out the handpicked questioners.
Exactly, and where it's all piety. And you know, the press tends to be overly pious with these religious hierarchical figures, and it kind of get very sentimental and watery. I mean, that CNN yesterday was that kind of thing. It was impossible to watch for that reason. And part of it, I think, is the ignorance of the press. I mean, I think in America, the press is profoundly ignorant of religion. And that's dangerous. It's very dangerous because you give these people, a free ride. For example, like I point out in my book, and this is fully documented there, 2 months after Reagan was sworn in as president, his National Security Council met in Santa Fe, and their one question was, how could we destroy liberation theology in Latin America? They concluded, we can't destroy it, but we can split the church. Then the head of CIA, Casey, who was a far right-wing Catholic, probably Opus Dei, took satchels, 29 trips he took to the Vatican with satchels full of cash to give to the Pope, to give to Solidarity, and in return the Pope would go after liberation theology in Latin America. So, I mean, the confluence of religion and politics and government in this country is profound, and yet so many media remain ignorant of religion. And they should be reading my book on the Pope. Someone very smart told me the other day, mine is the only book out there that really connects the dots on what's been happening the last 42 years in the papacy. And it's a big story. And it's not just about Ratzinger retiring. It's about the end of an 1,800-year-old institution in the West, and it's not dying gracefully. And what comes next? And that's how the last third of the book is about what comes next. And I think what comes next is small groups, based communities, trying to get back to the real teachings of Jesus. And the Vatican II helps, too. And these last two popes have been stuffing Vatican II, not playing out its principles, but actually deliberately ignoring the principles of the Second Vatican Council. And that's why I say they're in schism, because that's what schism is. When popes trump councils, that's not the tradition. In Catholicism, councils trump popes. But for 42 years, these two papacies have been turning back the clock on Vatican II, and everyone is paying a horrible price for this.
Well, Matthew Fox, I thank you so much for joining us here today, and I just can't wait to see the Vatican Bank closed down and its relationship to the CIA exposed.
Well, there you go. I wish I had the money to send you to Rome. You can ask that one important question.
Right. Well, I'll do what I can to find out. And I thank you for joining us.
You bet. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Matthew Fox, who's an internationally acclaimed theologian. He was a member of the Dominican Order for 34 years. Fox founded the Institute in Culture and Creation Spirituality, which operated for 7 years, but then became a prime target of Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, Pope John Paul II's chief inquisitor and head of the Congregation of Doctrine and Faith. Ratzinger, who later became Pope Benedict, silenced Fox for 1 year in 1988 and ultimately forced him to step down as director of the ICCS. 3 years later, he expelled Fox from the order. Fox is the author of 28 books, which have sold more than 1.5 million copies. His bestsellers include Original Blessing, A Spirituality Named Compassion, The Coming of the Cosmic Christ, and Prayer, A Radical Response to Life. His latest book is The Pope's War, Why Ratzinger's Secret Crusade Has Imperiled the Church and How It Can Be Saved. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into the epidemic of rape in the U.S. military.
Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so. Little ones to him belong, they are weak, but he is strong. Yes, Jesus loves me.
If she won't be a slave, then say that she don't love. Say she's trying to be a man. While putting her down, we pretend that she's above us. Woman is the nigger of the world. Yes, she is. You don't believe it, take a look at the woman.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kirby Dick, who is an Academy Award and Emmy-nominated documentary director whose films include Outrage, This Film Is Not Yet Rated, Twist of Faith, and his most recent, The Invisible War, a groundbreaking investigation into the epidemic of rape within the U.S. Armed Forces, the institutions that perpetuate and cover up its existence, and its profound personal and social consequences. The film won the Audience Award at the 2012 Sundance Film Festival and was nominated for this year's Academy Award. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kirby Dick.
Thank you. Glad to be on your show.
And you were at Wednesday's hearings in the Capitol, the Senate Armed Services Subcommittee on Personnel. And I take it that some of the women that testified about what has happened to them in serving this country, it's just shattering. I mean, it's shattering to read. So tell me what it was like, for example, to hear Sergeant Rebecca Havrilla.
The testimony was very devastating. Some of the people who were testifying yesterday were, these are very patriotic people who went in the military. Actually, you know, throughout the last several decades, they went in the military wanting a career, wanting to serve their country. They were sexually assaulted, raped, actually. And then when they had the courage to come forward and report, the military turned on them. So it was just, it was really tragic to hear their stories. And they were very, very powerful stories.
Well, in the case of Sergeant Rebecca Havrilla, who was a lone female member of a bomb squad in eastern Afghanistan, she was raped just before she was supposed to go back to the United States. She went to a military chaplain who said it must have been God's will for her to have been raped. And the person who raped her posted pictures of the rape on a pornographic website. So she was doubly violated. I find it just incomprehensible that this has been going on for some time and has not been addressed. What was your sense of whether or not there's going to be a sea change here?
Well, the hearings were historic yesterday. Not only was the victim's testimony so powerful, but they also had a number of two-star and three-star generals from all branches actually testified as well. And the Senate, particularly Senator, the senators there, particularly Senator Gillibrand, Senator Mikulski, Senator Rono, were very aggressive in their questioning of them, and actually very passionate in their statements that they were really outraged that this had gone on for so long, and that these branches, the heads of these branches, were still insisting that structural changes not be made to address this issue.
Well, actually, I should have to correct what I said, Kirby Dick. Sergeant Havrilla was violated three times. She was raped. The rape was posted on a pornographic website. And then when she went to her commanders for justice, they dismissed her complaints. So that is unfortunately not unusual, is it?
No, that's very, very common. In fact, in the making of our film, The Invisible War, we spoke to hundreds of survivors, and nearly every person who reported their assault, the military turned on them. And what we heard yesterday is echoed by hundreds of thousands of survivors over the last several decades. It's not uncommon at all. And what really needs to be done is the decisions to investigate and prosecute these crimes has to be moved outside of the chain of command, so there isn't a conflict of interest. As long as it's in the chain of command, You will have people reporting and then commanders covering it up or doing everything they can to cover it up. And not only is that bad enough, but what happens is people don't report when they know that there's this kind of situation. Right now, only 14% of men and women report at all. And we know that most of these assaults are caused by serial predators who assault again and again. So every time someone doesn't report, a serial predator goes on to assault again and again. So there has to be the structural change of moving it outside the chain of command. The military is fighting back on this. They're fighting back hard. But the good news is, for the first time, there are very powerful senators are confronting the military about making this change. And it's also happening to some degree in the House now. So we're encouraged, but there's a long way to go.
Again, I'm speaking with Kirby Dick, who's an Academy Award and Emmy-nominated documentary director, whose films include Outrage, This Film Is Not Yet Rated, Twist of Faith, and his most recent, The Invisible War, a groundbreaking investigation into the epidemic of rape within the U.S. Armed Forces, the institutions that perpetuate and cover up its existence, and its profound personal and social consequences. The film won the Audience Award at the 2012 Sundance Film Festival and was nominated for this year's Academy Award. Now, there is, of course, right on the front burner now, pretty glaring example of what you were just talking about, Kirby, with the overturning of a sexual assault conviction of Lieutenant Colonel James Wilkinson, who's a pilot and Inspector General of the 31st Fighter Wing in Aviano Air Base in Italy. He was found guilty of sexual assault and sentenced by a jury, but then Lieutenant General Craig Franklin overturned the decision and the conviction and allowing him to go free and to be reinstated into the Air Force. This apparently has been brought to the new Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel's attention, and he has apparently ordered a review of the case as well as the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So let's start with the Uniform Code of Military Justice. What kind of loophole is in that to allow this to happen?
Well, the loophole, again, goes back to this issue of the power of the chain of command. The convening authority, which in this case is probably a one- or two-star general, has the power to decide whether even to take a case to court-martial at all. If the investigator can come to him saying, we have a slam-dunk case, and he or she can just, the convening authority can just say, no, we don't want to move forward for whatever reason whatsoever. If they do move forward, the convening authority picks the jury, which is in this case was four colonels and a lieutenant colonel, picks the judge, and then, you know, in this case, they found this person guilty of sexual assault. And then after that, the convening authority can review that, even though it's decided by a jury, and decide to throw out any and all charges. And in the language, in the UCMJ, it says, for any reason or no reason. He can do it just on his own whim. If he decides he likes the person, which in this case we believe that he had an association with this person, that he was, and we don't know if he was good friends, but he knew this person, even though in Air Force, the judge advocate general said he didn't believe he did. I think that is incorrect. So this is the problem. So much power is vested in one person who, in this case, probably knew the assailant and probably, I would imagine, for personal reasons, certainly influenced his decision to overturn a jury's decision.
And the victim in this case, in the Wilkinson case that was overturned by the general, was a civilian physician assistant.
Yes, but in most cases, the accused, in this case, the convicted by a jury, the assailant was within the military. It was tried in the military. It's interesting. Even many times, if people are assaulted off a base and they go to civilian authorities, oftentimes the civilian authorities refer them back to the military authorities. So the military, you know, has an inordinate amount of power over all these cases. And unless they correct, you know, these significant structural problems that have been in existence for a long, long time, they will continue to have, these thousands and thousands of sexual assaults a year. 19,000 men and women are sexually assaulted each year.
Well, apparently, Senators Barbara Boxer and Jean Shaheen wrote to Hagel particularly about this case. And he said he had no authority under the Uniform Code of Military Justice to overturn Franklin's decision. So Chuck Hagel's...
That is astounding. I mean, this one person who's the convening authority, who has the power even decide to investigate, chooses the jury, chooses the judge. Also, if he decides to throw out the conviction, neither the chief of staff of the Air Force nor the Secretary of Defense nor the commander-in-chief himself can overturn that decision. That's how much power this convening authority has. That's what has to be changed. Now, there was a reason for it to exist 200 years ago. I mean, you know, a unit might be out in the field days, weeks away from anyone else, and the convening authority had to have that authority. But that's no longer the case. And it was very interesting. Senator Gillibrand asked a three-star general in the Air Force about this. He said, was justice done in this case? I mean, and this general would not say that there was no, that justice was not done, even though, again, you know, Lieutenant Colonel was convicted by a jury of Spears.
So it sounds like, though, that there is a problem in the Air Force, because the other scandal-plagued place is Lackland Air Force Base in Texas, along with Aviano in a NATO base in Italy. Apparently there are 62 female trainees at Lackland who have come forward saying that they've been sexually assaulted or harassed by their training instructors. So what's going on at Lackland?
Well, yes, this is a growing scandal. I mean, this is something that has been growing over the last year. I think you'll even see more and more victims coming forward. I do want to say that this is not a problem just confined to the Air Force, unfortunately. This is a problem across all branches. It just happens to be that these latest scandals that came forward relate to the Air Force. But I'm sure there's many, many more scandals we're not hearing about in all the other branches. But one of the things that's very interesting about, and I found this out anecdotally at least from talking to the hundreds of survivors, a lot of these assaults take place in training environments like Lackland, where you have these recruits coming out of boot camp, very idealistic, trusting everybody at the bottom of the chain of command, going into a situation to get advanced training, and then getting befriended by like a trainer who's obviously way up the chain of command or someone else who's a serial predator who befriends them, sets them up, and assaults them. And then they know, because they're so well respected, the assailant is so well respected, they know that even if the person comes forward to report, that person won't be believed, or that it's just not worth it for the commander to go after a star trainer. It's just not worth it. So what happens is these people then, they're only in the training environment for about 8 weeks. They leave, and then the trainer, who is a serial predator, when the next group comes in, picks out another victim to assault. And you see this again and again and again. I saw this again and again and again talking to the subjects in our film. I mean, it was just astonishing. The military has to look at all its training environments. I think that's where a good deal of these assaults are going on. Not to say that they're not going on in a lot of other places. They are, but I think it's concentrated in those environments.
So in the making of your film, which was nominated for this year's Academy Award in the feature documentary category, Kirby Dick, The Invisible War, what was your conclusion about the psychology of men in uniform who see women as just a piece of meat that's on their plate, and that they don't seem to have any compulsion about ravaging them, and they don't seem to have any guilt about it? So What is it in the military culture that allows for that kind of dehumanization of a fellow soldier?
Well, certainly there is significant misogyny within the military. I don't think anybody would deny that. But I do want to say that most men are horrified. Most men are not sexual predators. They're not rapists. And most men are horrified by this. These assaults are being committed by a small minority of serial predators who have been allowed to get away with it again and again. They really, the military has an embedded serial predator problem that it hasn't addressed. And that's the real problem. And these serial predators, they have absolutely no respect for their victims whatsoever. I mean, these are people that have to be caught and incarcerated. In the military, again, it has a broken criminal justice system, one that allows this conflict of interest allows commanders to let these people go, and that has to be changed. So I just want to clarify. I do think there's cultural issues here within the military. There is a problem with the military culture. I think the military, particularly since the Invisible War, the film came out, is trying to address that. They have a long way to go. Where they're really falling short is going after these serial predators. They haven't, they tell me personally, I was in the Pentagon, they say, you can't prosecute your way out of this. Yes, you can. The most important thing for them to do is go after these serial predators who have probably assaulted 20 people or more, and probably will go on to assault another 20 people or more, then leave with honorable discharges and then assault civilians. They need to put these people behind bars. The military has the capability to do this. They just have to change their system so they get it done.
Yeah, but what explains, Kirby Dick, what explains the cover-ups by higher-ups, officers who either tell the victims to go away and suck it up, or know what's happened and yet forgive or free, or give these predators a free pass, as opposed to be the case with General Franklin letting Colonel Wilkerson free?
Yeah. I mean, in many cases, these serial predators are actually star performers. And so, and I don't know if this is the case, I know this was true actually in the Wilkerson case. So I don't know if you know, Franklin, in this case, there's no excuse for Franklin overturning a jury. But in some cases, when somebody at the bottom of a victim who's at the bottom of the, you know, just very low ranking comes forward and accuses a star performer, and the commander knows the star performer may have and known them for a long time and trusts them, then they oftentimes make incorrectly the decision to not prosecute. I mean, serial predators, to investigate and prosecute sexual assault crimes is very, very difficult. And people seem to think, commanders seem to think that they can tell who's a serial predator. You can't. That's why it has to be, the decision has to be moved away from these commanders to trained prosecutors. They can be within the military, but trained prosecutors who know how to investigate and prosecute these crimes. It's not being done. That's why these serial predators are not being prosecuted or not being prosecuted effectively.
So given that the ban on women in combat was just lifted in January, is that likely to change the atmosphere? Because now you've got women fighting right next to men. Is that going to make a difference?
Well, you know, this is something that's long overdue. I'm completely in favor of it because for one thing, it gives a real opportunity for advancement. And without that, women are second-class citizens, and we know if that's the case, there's more harassment. And we know if there's more harassment within a unit, it really allows serial predators to operate more freely. So in that regard, it will, over time, I think, affect this, you know, reduce the amount of sexual assault in the military. Not necessarily by a lot, but I think it will have a positive effect. Again, where they're falling down is they're not prosecuting. They're not going after serial predators. And you know, you ask, well, why? What's wrong with the military? Why aren't they getting a grip on this? I think, you know, the military, like any other powerful institution, like Penn State, like the Catholic Church, their first instinct is to cover this up, even, you know, whether it's on a commander level or across the force. They want to cover this up, and that's why it's so important that Congress in this country put pressure on them to change this. I mean, they can do that. In some ways, they're better situated to go after serial predators than the civilian world is. But right now, they're failing miserably.
Well, just in closing, Kirby Dick, since you attended Wednesday's Senate hearings before the Armed Services Subcommittee on Personnel on the issue of rape in the military and the compounding victimization of women who have been raped, you mentioned a number of the senators, Kirsten Gillibrand and others, who were in attendance, but who was there on the Republican side?
Well, Senator Lindsey Graham was trying to sort of defend the status quo, you know, saying that, you know, we shouldn't judge the entire system by this one Franklin Wilkerson case. Well, we know that this is just one case among thousands and thousands. And so that is, you know, I mean, to really to get anything through Congress, there has to be a bipartisan effort. But so there's a lot of work to do, and I think the military is counting on, in this case, the minority party in the Senate, the Republican Party, sort of to defend the status quo. What was good to see, though, is the level of outrage from senators. You know, 2 years ago, it was almost impossible for me to even get a senator to go on camera and speak in my film about this issue. So to see senators outraged, going after the military brass with very hard questions and getting the kind of coverage it has, I think is a really important first step. And I think there's momentum here, and you know, one of the things we're doing, you know, sort of behind the scenes is trying to reach out not only to the Democratic side but to the Republican side as well, because we feel this should be a bipartisan issue. We think everybody can agree that, you know, we should defend, you know, we should protect the men and women who are protecting us. So we're hopeful that this pressure will continue to build and the Republican side will come around as well. There are Republicans in the House, in particular, Representative Mike Turner, who's been a real fighter on this for a long, long time. And he appeared in our film and he was very outspoken on this when even many Democrats weren't. So, nothing can happen in Congress without bipartisan support. So we're trying to build that.
Well, Kirby Dick, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Kirby Dick, who's an Academy Award and Emmy-nominated documentary director whose films include Outrage, This Film Was Not Yet Rated, Twist of Faith, and his most recent, The Invisible War, a groundbreaking investigation into the epidemic of rape within the U.S. Armed Forces, the institutions that perpetuate and cover up its existence, and its profound personal and social consequences. The film won the Audience Award at the 2012 Sundance Film Festival and was nominated for this year's Academy Award. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and get an update from CPAC, the conservative gathering just outside of Washington.
I used to sail the deep and tranquil sea. But it washed me ashore. And it took my thinking that my love.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from CPAC, just outside of Washington, is Adele Stan, who is AltaNet's Washington Bureau Chief. She has an article at altanet.org, Rand Paul, No Progressive Hero Despite Anti-Drone Filibuster. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stan.
Thank you so much for having me back, Ian.
Well, thank you for being our on-the-spot reporter at CPAC. I mean, I must admit, there's a certain masochism that liberals clearly have, that they can't get enough of these conservative wacko birds, to quote John McCain.
Yeah, there's a good handful of liberal and progressive reporters here.
So what is the fascination? Because it used to be that there were authentic conservatives who were quite coherent, going back to William F. Buckley and even Jack Kemp and more. But now it's CPAC seems to be a gathering of the fringe sort of talk show circus that has taken over the Republican Party to some extent, the Breitbarts and company, as well as people like Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, who spoke there today. So give us a flavor of what the percentage is of, and because Christie's not there. Instead of Christie, they've got Donald Trump. You know what I'm saying? It's pretty clear that this is a gathering of wacko birds.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, in a lot of ways, Chris Christie notwithstanding, because he's really rather an outlier, this is your Republican Party, Ian Masters. This is how it is. And if you look at the agenda, of course, the people that capture the imaginations of reporters are the people you talk about, Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, Jim DeMint, these kinds of characters. But, you know, Mitch McConnell spoke here. He just, you know, doesn't really matter anymore, even though he's the Senate majority leader and the leader of the Republican Party in the Congress.
Right, and he's certainly not as cute as Ashley Judd, I must say.
Right, well, then there's that. But, I mean, I think really the larger point is that, you know, what CPAC really is it's sort of a gathering of all elements of the conservative movement. So at other gatherings, say, the Faith and Freedom Coalition gathering or the Values Voters Summit, you get the religious right. At other gatherings, you get the more secular libertarian right. At Republican Party gatherings, you get those who are, you know, who are very closely affiliated with the party. This is the one gathering every year where the whole of the movement comes together in one place. And, of course, the people who steal the stage are the people that you describe as, quote-unquote, wacko birds.
Well, Adele Stan, of course, they have this straw poll that is taken seriously, even though it's not serious, and and fairly consistently Rand Paul's father, Ron Paul, has won it. This year, Jeb Bush asked his name to be taken out of the straw poll, which I think is a dead sure sign that he's running for president. But
and he's going to be speaking here on Friday night.
Sure. So you've got the fact that Ron Paul and these young libertarians that have been attracted to him, who I believe this, they're in quite a lot of them on the floor there at CPAC. He's really done some groundwork for his son. So I think you can see a party that is splitting with the old national security hawks like McCain and Lindsey Graham and having tantrums against Rand Paul and Rand Paul and Ted Cruz, you know, carving out some new territory. Is that what's going on?
Yeah, I do think that a good chunk of this is generational. And I thought it was really fascinating today to see Marco Rubio on the podium just ahead of Rand Paul. Two very different kinds of figures, but both of a generation that, you know, that the very people you're talking about, and that includes Ted Cruz, are vying for. I mean, the Republican Party is trying to expand its base. Its base is basically old white people right now, right? So they're trying to make an appeal to the young. And, you know, in that, I do think that Rand Paul has an advantage because the ideology of, say, Marco Rubio is more like sort of an old man's ideology coming out of, you know, a cute younger guy. Whereas Rand Paul is offering something completely different, especially when he calls for an end to the drug war and echoes some progressive positions on civil liberties and does not talk about his hostility to women's rights and gay rights.
So when he said at CPAC today, when Rand Paul said those things that liberals like to hear, how did the audience respond?
Well, that was what was really interesting, because here at CPAC, there usually is a pretty good contingent of young people and a lot of what I would call Paulites, you know, in other words, Ron Paul followers of Rand Paul's dad, who are young, tend to be college students. But you also have a lot of older people who travel from, you know, far and away. So my sense of the audience, and of course the media are kept here in sort of a pen behind the rest of the audience in the ballroom. My sense of things were that, you know, he got pretty lukewarm responses to his, when he asserted and went on a bit about the expansion of executive power being a big problem, when he talked about how terrible it was that American soldiers are being killed to support policies that actually are contra the Constitution. He was received kind of just barely politely on that, except for the Ron Paul people who and the younger people. One guy yelled out, you know, "Don't drone me, bro," reference to Rand Paul's anti-drone filibuster. But when he went and slammed Egypt and slammed Obama for sending aid to Egypt, which he described as a nation hostile to U.S. interests and hostile to Israel, he got huge applause on that. You know,
so that's the old Islamophobia card being played.
Absolutely, and that played very, very well to this crowd. So I think that you can see where the tensions are in the party just by this sort of, you know, conflict-driven responses to Rand Paul's own speech. I mean, it was all there. There were things they loved about him and things that they were like, oh, I don't know about that.
Right. Again, I'm speaking with Adele Stan, who is at CPAC's meeting just outside of Washington. She is AltaNet's Washington Bureau Chief, and she has an article at AltaNet, Rand Paul's No Progressive Hero Despite Anti-Drone Filibuster. And it's pretty extraordinary to see how many liberals, I think, were taken in by Rand Paul. And there's no question that taking to the Senate floor and bringing up this extremely important issue of drones and presidential authority to assassinate American citizens, nothing is more important.
In the face of Democratic cowardice on that.
Exactly. No Democrat stood up and did it. But that doesn't mean that this is the right messenger for any liberal cause. I mean, this is a guy who sponsored the Fetal Personhood Amendment. And as you've written, Adele, he's a medical doctor who would rather see a woman dead of a botched abortion than one discarded fetus. And he's a white man who thinks private property trumps equal access to public accommodations for people of all races. So I basically think that most of the audience that Rand Paul is talking to are conservative, and some of them are quite out there on the fringes. And he's vying to take over a party and run for president. And surely he's appealing to the worst elements of who have captured this party: the birthers, the gun nuts, the creationists, this crowd. I mean, there's nothing worse than that toxic stew of ignorance and hatred, particularly towards our first black president.
Yeah, I couldn't argue that with you, and I agree with you entirely. And you know what? As I've said, this filibuster was, you know, this was carefully planned, and believe me, it was a genius public relations move on Rand Paul's part. Just brilliant. And what it was the opening bid of his presidential campaign. And, you know, and you have all of these liberal guys or progressive guys, you know, kind of fawning over him, calling him heroic and courageous, and sending out tweets with the hashtag #StandWithRand and all of this kind of thing. And what they are helping him to do is accrue more power to himself, as they help catapult him into media attention, and as they make him seem as if he's, you know, not so bad, not such a bad guy, right? That's the overall impression you get when you see somebody who is part of the progressive brand, you know, presenting the guy that way. And now, that said, Ian, I mean, it was just dreadful that the Democrats just bowed down on the nomination of John Brennan to lead the CIA, and that only three Democrats voted against that nomination, and that Democrats and progressive legislators have not been doing what they need to be doing to oppose targeted assassinations, to oppose torture, to oppose these things. So, but it's much harder work, you know, to do the organizing that creates conditions that makes it impossible for your senator or your legislator to not address these issues. It's much easier to name somebody a hero who is already on the floor, and I think that's what we saw happening.
Well, Adele, I thank you for joining us from CPAC. And if you find somebody from your father's or grandfather's Republican Party, be sure to interview him or her, will you?
I certainly will. It's a great idea, Ian. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, who is at CPAC, their gathering just outside of Washington. She is Alternet's Washington Bureau Chief, and she has an article at Alternet, Rand Paul, No Progressive Hero Despite Anti-Drone Filibuster. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.